Welcome to the first podcast of Where is the Support? On one sunny and unusually warm Friday afternoon in early May, I had the opportunity to interview the executive director of the Ali Fournay Center in Chelsea, New York City. As I waited for him in the front waiting room, I was struck by the joyful colors that covered the walls and the friendly volunteer and youth who immediately greeted and started conversation with me. It was then that Carl walked in with a smiling face and took me to his office. And so the interview began.
I'm Carl Suliano. I'm the founder and the executive director of the Ali Fournay Center, and we are in the Ali Fournay Day Center on West 22nd Street in Chelsea in New York City.
And maybe if you could also just give me a little bit of background history of the organization and where the name Ali Fournay came from.
Sure. Ali Fournay was one of the many young people who I met back in the 1990s when I helped to run a drop-in center for homeless youth in Times Square. And at that time, there was no shelter for LGBT youth in New York City. And Ali was, he had an interesting identification, because sometimes she was Luscious, and sometimes he was Ali, and sometimes she identified as trans, and sometimes he identified as a gay boy, and so there was this kind of fluidity to Ali's gender, but Ali was one of the homeless gay youth of New York City. And Ali was one of the many young people that I knew who was actually murdered in the 1990s on the streets of New York. And I was very devastated by Ali's death, and had cared very deeply for Ali and didn't want his name to vanish. So when it came time a few years later for me to start a program for homeless LGBT youth, it just seemed natural to me that I would name it after Ali. Ali had been a real advocate for the other kids on the street, and was really dedicated to HIV prevention. You know, back in those days, you know, I was sort of dying of AIDS in a way that's not quite so dramatic anymore. And Ali would, almost all of the young people that were homeless at that time were surviving through prostitution, because they just didn't have the support they needed to get off the streets and get jobs.
Right.
So Ali also was supporting himself through prostitution. He would go out with a huge bag of condoms every day and give them to all the other kids prostituting on the street and really talk to them about how to keep themselves safe. And then as these murders were happening in like 96 and 97, Ali would actually go to the police and aggressively advocate that they, you know, try to resolve these murders, and he would, you know, have clues about when, you know, his friends were last seen and what cars they got into. None of the murders of the homeless LGBT youth in New York were ever solved back in the 90s, and then Ali was murdered himself. But I kind of felt like, in this climate where there was so much neglect of these kids and so little value placed on their lives, I felt like Ali was somebody who really stood out for showing that he believed that his friends and the other kids on the street mattered. So I was inspired by that, and that also has to do with why I named the program Ali for him, because I wanted to give honor to the fact that he gave honor to the kids.
Right. So before he was murdered, did you already know that you wanted to open up something, or?
I was working at this program, Safe Space, back in the 90s, and we were not a program for LGBT, we were for everybody, but we were very conscious of the fact that at least a third of the kids in the city were LGBT, who were on the streets. So at that time, I was actually aggressively trying to put funding together to open a shelter, and had been, you know, going to city public policy planning bodies and advocating. And I remember after Ali was murdered, I had to go advocate for funding somewhere, and I remember I had pounded my fist on the podium and said I was so sick and tired of coming to these things and then having to go and bury these kids because they didn't have anywhere to sleep. And that was sort of like when we started getting money to create housing in Safe Space. And we did, we created, by 99, you know, Ali was murdered in 97, and by 99 we were able to start opening up housing. But Safe Space ended up having some serious financial problems. Most of the programs that I opened up shut down in 2001 and 2002. And while Safe Space had been a program that was for all the homeless kids, during the 90s, I started seeing that it was harder for the gay kids to come to a mixed program. it's ironic. You think that things get more progressive and yeah. become more open. But in the homeless youth scene in New York in the 90s, there was progressively a real kind of gang involvement, like the Latin Kings, the Bloods, the Crips. And, you know, the kids would get arrested, they'd go to jail, they'd get recruited into the gangs, and then the gangs started realizing that homeless youth were sort of like good prospective members, so they would like go to homeless youth service centers and try to recruit in the gangs. And it's like you absolutely couldn't be in the gang if you were gay. I mean, they'd kill you for being gay. So it became a more homophobic environment, with me, a gay man, running the program, and even with like at least a third of the staff being gay.
Yeah.
And I started realizing that for the gay kids to be safe, I had to like start doing some discreet programming for them. So I had a scattered site housing program at Safe Space where I rented apartments and would put kids up in apartments with staff supervision. And I ended up deciding to make one of the apartments like specifically for gay kids so that they would have a space where they didn't have to deal with any of that.
Yeah.
And it was interesting for me to see how much they responded to it and how much safer and more comfortable and relaxed they felt when they just didn't have to be on guard all the time about, you know, protecting themselves. It was very illustrative to me. And when Safe Space started losing its funding, and I realized that it would be like back to like square one where the gay kids had nowhere to go but Covenant House, that was when I realized, you know, that in honor and memory of Ali, I wanted to do something that you know, was a program specifically to house homeless gay kids. And, you know, I also felt like, okay, here we are in New York City, kind of the birthplace of the modern gay rights movement, and all these gay kids are on the street. I mean, it just seemed kind of shameful that we as a gay community weren't doing more to protect the kids and stand up for them. So in 2002, I started the Alternative Center.
And are there any other programs in New York City that are like this program?
There are none that are like this in terms, I mean, we're significantly the most comprehensive and the largest program housing LGBT youth in the country. We have, tonight we have 48 beds, and we're going to have 54 beds because we're opening a new program in July. You know, we have really comprehensive mental health, medical services, substance abuse treatment, job training, vocational placement. We really, you know, when I started this, my thought was gay kids need somewhere safe to be on off the street at night. But my thinking has really kind of evolved now to where I'm thinking, okay, we're in the middle of this kind of social upheaval where thousands of kids are coming out as teens now, and in such a divided society where, you know, it's just a significant percentage of the parents that they come out to aren't going to be able to accept and cope with having these kids and stop effectively parenting them.
Yeah.
And so it seems to me that the gay community has to create structures that make it safe for these kids to transition from being teenagers to adults and, you know, figure out ways to get them in school and figure out ways to get them jobs and figure out ways to get them living independently. So it's not just that we're sheltering now, we're really trying to do everything that a family and a supportive community should be doing to help kids grow up safely.
So maybe you can talk a little bit about like what types of programs you have here. So you have like a day program and...
Sure. You know, where we are right now is our day center, and it's really the entry point for our young people. It's in the Chelsea neighborhood in Manhattan, and it's kind of a very gay neighborhood, and it's walking distance to the Christopher Street Piers, where a lot of the homeless gay youth hang out. So we're very fortunate to have this space. We have outreach workers who go out onto the street and find young people and make them aware of the services that they have. And people come here, and it's kind of like an entry point slash triage place. You know, everybody comes here, they get an intake, figure out who they are and what their needs are. We work with them to find them emergency housing. We help them get into our housing when they're waiting lists to get into our housing. We help them figure out what other options there are while they're waiting. We have a medical clinic on site. We have a mental health clinic. We have a psychiatrist. We have a really advanced HIV testing, treatment and prevention program. And then we have two different housing programs, both scattered in apartments. One is an emergency housing program where young people can stay for up to 6 months.
Okay.
And that's, you know, open to every homeless LGBT youth between the ages of 16 and 24. I mean, the only eligibility is that you have to be homeless and LGBT between 16 and 24. And we really work to stabilize the young people while they're there, you know, figure out who they are, what their needs are, if they're substance substance abuse issues, help them deal with that. If they're mental health issues, help them deal with that. Help them get HIV tested and deal with their HIV status if that's an issue. And then we have a transitional housing program where they have to stay for 2 years. And the transitional housing program would require that they work on some level. And coming in, that can mean a full-time job, a part-time job, even an internship or a volunteer job. They have to show us they're willing to work.
Right.
And then we require that if they haven't graduated from high school, they either go back into high school or be in a GED program. And we have an on-site GED program at a second drop-in center that we have out in Brooklyn. And then we don't mandate it, but we, you know, really encourage young people to go, you know, continue their education and go to college. Right now, like half the kids in the transitional program are actively in college. Almost all of them are working. And, you know, it's kind of amazing now because the transitional program has just been open about 2 years now. And so people are graduating and moving out, getting their own places and have great jobs. And so it's really gratifying to see that. And then we have the second drop-in site in Brooklyn, which is sort of like a support center for the kids in housing.
Okay.
And the services there are more focused towards, like, you know, voc ed, GED program, job training, placement program, independent living skills programs, kind of helping the kids in housing figure out how to be more independent and get out there on their own.
Okay, that's great. And, like, do you ever turn youth away?
All the time.
What types of reasons would you turn youth away for?
Well, we always have a waiting list for our housing.
Okay.
So, you know, there's just an issue of supply and demand. I don't want to turn anybody away, but if you've got 48 beds and 200 kids trying to get into those 48 beds, you have to, you know, it's not like you just, like, bye, go. We
need
them to find them other places and
right.
put them on the waiting list. And then in the drop-in center here, although, like, now it's, like, a beautiful afternoon and it's, like, really warm outside, so the kids are all up at the piers, but often, especially in the morning, like, we'll have more people wanting to be here than we have space to safely accommodate.
Right.
So sometimes we'll have to say, you know, it's full, come back in an hour.
Yeah.
So that's the way we'd be turning people away from the drop-in center. But,
okay.
You know, it's, you know, not more than like an hour.
Right, okay. And then you mentioned that, so you do referrals to other programs as well? And what would be the most common services or programs that you would refer youth to?
You know, I would say that the closest linkage we have is with our medical provider. We have a subcontract with the Institute for Urban Family Health, and they have a medical clinic. Like, they have a full-service primary care facility on 16th Street. So, you know, our kids are constantly kind of going back and forth between here and there to get, you know, more of their own ongoing medical care.
Yeah.
But we work really closely with, like, Hendrick Martin Institute, with the LGBT, with the New York City Anti-Violence Project, Green Chimneys, which has a transitional housing program for LGBT youth, the Bronx Community Pride Center, which is a drop-in center in the Bronx. There are a whole, every program in the city that has anything to do with LGBT youth, we work closely with.
Yeah.
We work very closely with the Peter Cicchino Project at the Urban Justice Center. They offer free legal assistance to homeless LGBT youth, and they actually come here once a week and have a legal clinic.
Oh.
A lot of our kids are dealing with, you know, a significant number of young people who come here are from other countries and have immigration issues.
Okay.
So we deal a lot with trying to help them be able to stay legally in the country and you know, improve their immigration status. Some of our kids have, you know, emancipation issues. Some of our kids, are like in foster care and don't want to be returned to their homes because of the homophobia and the violence that they are subjected to. And, you know, so we're working with the Peter Cicchino Project to make sure that the youth are not returned into unsafe situations and that the homophobia is recognized. So we just work with a whole bunch of programs.
Yeah, and actually I was going to ask you if, like, most of the youth that come here are actually from New York, or have you noticed that youth actually travel from different states just to come here because of the Allen Fortney Center?
Well, you know, it's interesting. When I started the Allen Fortney Center, almost all of the young people coming to us were, like, New York City and, you know, 20-mile radius. And now, I would say that only 50% of our kids are from the local New York area. Well, we've got a lot of kids coming from other states, and a lot of kids, you know, I would say that 15% of our kids now are from other countries, with a really heavy proportion of those coming from Jamaica and the Caribbean. mean, I actually think that it's clear, becoming more clear to me that this is a real international issue, and that there's like this kind of impact that like the internet and access to information that people have everywhere has, where people in Africa and in Jamaica and in Trinidad have just as much access now to the fact that people are gay and that they're out of the closet and that they're able to make lives for themselves as they do here because of the internet. So young people, though, don't have the greatest ability to gauge how safe it is for them to come out. So when they come out in those places, they're often in incredible danger and end up fleeing for their lives. Yeah, we've had a lot of like kids from other countries really here because they were dealing with death threats and stuff like that.
And like, have you seen any youth here from Canada?
That's interesting. I can't think of anybody off the top of my head, but I mean, we've got kids from like Iowa.
Right. Yeah.
That's almost Canada.
And have you ever
That's only from Vermont. That's pretty close.
Yeah, that's true. That's pretty close.
I'm sure we have. I just can't think mm-hmm. off the top of my head.
Yeah, it'd be hard to remember where everyone's
from. We've got over 1,000 people come here, so.
Exactly. And have you ever witnessed homophobia happen here?
You know, I would say that some of our young people internalized homophobia mm-hmm. and are very shady to one another. Your wig looks like roadkill.
Yeah.
You think you look like Beyonce, but you really look like Rihanna after the beatdown.
Right.
I mean, I hear that stuff, and I'm like, that's like internalized self-hatred being projected outward. I mean, you know, the kids have just gotten so many awful messages about being hateful and shameful and unworthy, and it's really easy for them to go to a place where they're just projecting that on each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we work a lot with them to kind of create an environment of respecting themselves and one another. I mean, it feels to me like it's one of the really important parts of the work that we do.
Yeah. Okay. And what would you say are the top three reasons that youth are homeless?
Number one, their parents can't cope with their sexuality, their sexual identities, their sexual or gender identities, everything that doesn't jive with just normal heterosexuality. Whatever that is. Two, substance abuse issues, and three, mental health issues.
Okay.
Either themselves or in their homes and their families.
Right.
Various combinations of that.
Yeah, right. Okay.
And often it's like, the kid is dealing with, parents with mental health issues and parents with substance abuse issues. And it's not like the parents' homophobia is like the only thing. It just often seems like it's the tipping point.
Yeah.
It's already a crazy situation,
yeah.
But they're being gay just makes the whole thing totally dysfunctional.
Right. Okay. And within the shelter system, where would you say the majority of homophobia comes from? Like, do you think it comes from staff working at agencies or from other youth attending services?
You know, when I hear the young people talk about their experiences in the big shelter in New York, which is Covenant House, what I hear most often is, like, the kids harassing and beating each other up. One of the things that I love to hear the kids say is that, the other kids will be beating them up and harassing them, and then the staff will perceive that their gayness or their flamboyance or their putting it out there too much is what's provoking the other kids, so they're seen as the problem.
Right.
And, I remember one instance with Covenant House where, this was a couple years ago, there used to be an outreach program run by the Greenwich Village Youth Council that has since lost its funding, but they had a contract with the city, and they were supposed to like find homeless kids in the middle of the night and bring them to whatever shelter and had open space. So they were bringing this gay kid to Covenant House, and the intake worker was like, "Well, he's going to go to hell because he's gay, and this is an abomination to God." And,
wow.
The person who was coordinating that project actually contacted Covenant House's management and was like, "It's really unacceptable.
Absolutely.
And what are you going to do about it?" And they're like, "Well, we have to be sensitive to her because she's talking from her cult see it both ways. I see it both ways.
Okay.
I mean, I think in terms of the daily experience of the kids, it's like being beaten up and harassed by other kids.
Right.
But it's also staff that are not, that are enabling it in various ways and are supportive of it in other ways. You know, somebody that's in a management position at that program was heard to say at a party after he got drunk that, you know, he thinks homosexuality is sinful and evil, and, you know, he's in a senior management position. I mean, I don't know if he's still there, but a year ago he was still in a senior management position in their transitional residence. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm going to say, like, the Roman Catholic Church is very, you know, clear that homosexuality is wrong and sinful, and that gay people shouldn't have equal rights in society. And I think that when you're dealing with a population that has gay kids in it, I don't know that public funding should be going to organizations and to religions to provide services if they're ipso facto indicating that they support discrimination against this population.
Exactly.
You know, and it feels to me like we're not going to be really empowered as a community until we can start saying that this is unacceptable, that our kids deserve to be treated. You know, it's like making a black kid go to something run by the Jumper Society or something. You know, it's like, why would you give a contract to a discriminatory organization, you know, or an organization coming out of a discriminatory belief system to work with a kid that they're discriminating against.
Mm-hmm.
It really makes me upset. And I'm a nice Italian Catholic boy, so...
Yeah.
So, but I still think it's wrong.
And how do we raise awareness of this? Like, what would you say?
Again, I think that the gay community needs to become more engaged in understanding its responsibility to protect youth. You know, I think that we have internalized to a certain extent the idea that homosexuality is an adult issue.
Mm-hmm.
Like, sexuality is adult, and certainly any kind of sexual difference is very adult.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids are showing that it's not. I mean, people become aware of their sexual desires, certainly by puberty.
Right.
And so we have to start thinking, we as a community need to understand that it's our responsibility to advocate for and protect our kids. And I think that we're a little bit behind the curve right now.
Yeah.
I think that if you look at where gay people are really experiencing violent, oppressive treatment, it's disproportionately teens that are experiencing that. It's like, you know, these kids that are committing suicide because they can't stand the bullying that they're going through in their schools.
Mm-hmm.
Kids like Larry King, you know, is murdered for expressing his interest in another boy.
Yeah.
All of these kids are getting beaten up and put out of their homes for being gay. I mean, you know, stuff like that is not happening to me as a grown-up gay man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't experience anything like that.
Right.
You know, it's disturbing to me how it's these kids that are really bearing so much of the brunt of the homophobia in our society right now, and how much they need us, the gay adults, to be demanding their protection.
Mm-hmm.
And how we're not quite there yet.
Yeah.
You know, we're very focused on marriage. Look, I want to get married too. I mean, I'm not saying not to be concerned about marriage, but as concerned as we are about marriage, we have to be concerned about our kids.
Yeah.
For us to, you know, everybody says, like, you know, somehow homosexuality is against the family or whatever, that's bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but we also have to step up to the plate and show our family values by making sure that we're protecting our kids.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very well said. And, like, I'm not sure if you know, but, like, as you may know, that there is no emergency or crisis shelter in Toronto specifically for LGBT homeless youth.
I only know because you told me before you started the podcast.
Okay. So, knowing that, is there any advice that you could offer to the existing support services in Toronto in order for them to become more queer-friendly?
I think a really important thing for any service organization that wants to be accessible to LGBT youth is to make sure that you've got openly gay staff. I think that's a huge signifier of safety and acceptance for young people. So if you're providing a youth service environment where there are no openly gay staff, I think that the kids will be afraid to come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it'll be easier for the, you know, if the clients have to figure out how to deal with the staff respectfully, then it will help them figure out how to deal with each other respectfully. So to me, that's the biggest thing. If you're working with a population that you know is partly LGBT, then to be culturally competent, you need to be having openly gay staff feel like they can work there.
Right.
And you have to prioritize that. And then, you know, I mean, obviously, like, having rainbow flags and signs and things that signify that you care about gay people always helps gay kids feel a little safer and more able to come out. And, you know, I don't think they should just be tolerated. Like, I kind of am not a huge fan anymore of tolerance. I mean, like, I don't want to be tolerated. I don't want to be loved, you know?
Yeah.
Tolerated sounds like somebody's holding their nose and just tolerating you. You know, so, like, you provide space for them to be themselves, to do their voguing, to kiki about Beyonce, to, you know, I'm you know, having, like, gay support groups within, like, a larger program, I think, is important. You know, giving space to young people and figuring out ways to help them and for the staff to celebrate their identity. Like, you know, if you make a big deal about, like, I'm not sure if they do this in Canada, but, like, you know, you'll have, like, Women's Pride Month or Black Pride Month.
Right.
And, you know, celebrate Gay Pride Month.
Yeah.
You know, put up stuff about Harvey Milk and about the Stonewall riots and show that our culture and our history and our struggle is something that's valued and important. I mean, all of those things just go a long way towards making gay kids feel better able to be out and open and safe.
Yeah. I actually just wanted to ask something from the beginning of the interview, and you had mentioned all the murders that were happening in the 90s. After you opened up the Ally Fournier Center, did the murder stop? Like, was there...
You know, one of the things that was really striking for me was that in the 90s when I was at Safe Space, like I was at Safe Space from 94 to 99 when we didn't have any shelter. And then in 99, I started opening shelter. And from the time that I started opening shelter, none of our kids died. You know, and prior to that, every couple of months, one of the kids would die. So it's just so clear to me that safe access to shelter is like a life and death thing. And since we've opened the Ally Fournier Center, we've had one or two young people die. And it's like somebody was like riding the train and fell off, you know, which was tragic. But I mean, you know, that had nothing to do with his housing. That was bad choice that he made. But I'm not aware that any of our young people have been murdered.
Okay. And from the staff that work here, are you the only person who's met Ally Fournier?
No. When you say here, you mean the Ally Fournier Center as opposed to this building?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Currently, how many people on staff? There are at least three people besides me who knew Ally Fournier.
Okay.
Yeah. We actually had a year ago, it was the 10th anniversary of his murder, and we did a celebration of his life at Judson Memorial Church, and a whole bunch of people that knew and remembered him, including his sister, came and spoke and talked about.
Wow, this is really amazing work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you want to add in before we end off here?
No, good.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.